Europe acknowledges the traditional owners of the land this podcast was recorded on. We pay our respect to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend this to all First Nations people. Hello, and welcome to the first episode for Season 2 of ARUP's Sustainable Forces podcast. I'm Dr. Michelle Dickinson. I'm an engineer, nanotechnologist, and science communicator. And I'm so happy to be back bringing new stories of sustainable development made possible through collaboration. If you're a new listener, welcome. In this podcast, I speak to people who join forces to create positive outcomes for the planet. I don't know about you, but since we finished Season 1, I've been thinking a lot about the topics that we covered. Local flooding where I live made me think about spongy cities, and as I've travelled around with my work, I've started noticing the small design features in cities that help them to feel more welcome, which I'd probably have walked past before. I've also become a mother to twins, and there is nothing like being a parent to make you determined to help the world to move to a sustainable future faster for the next generation. Which is why I'm really excited to jump back in today and share our first episode for Season 2. Can design repair the planet? I spoke to Jennifer Lenhart, Cities Lead for World Wildlife Fund, and Joseph Hargrave from ARUP, all about regenerative design. What is it? Which cities are doing it well? And how can we all play our part in regenerating our cities? I was so inspired by Jennifer's passion for city and her stories from where she has lived and worked all around the world that she might have tempted me to join her on a bicycle ride. Joseph shares an insightful exploration of what regenerative design means and what it means in different regions across the globe. Here is my conversation with Jennifer and Joseph. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, how are you?
I am great, thank you. We also have on this podcast Joseph Hargrave. He is our global foresight leader to help us understand how we can use regenerative design to restore our relationship with nature. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Michelle. Pleasure to be here.
Amazing. Okay, well, we're going to get started by figuring out who you are and how you're involved in this. So, Jennifer, I'm going to start with you. We've chatted before and you described yourself as a cosmopolitan nomad. And you said that your home is wherever you park your bicycle. Where are you joining us from today? Where is your home?
Yes, good morning. My current home, if you will, is in Santiago de Chile. So we're here in the winter and I'm staring out at the beautiful snow-capped Andean peak.
Amazing. But you're not from Chile originally?
No, I am not. I am half Swedish, but grew up in the United States. I've lived in about 25 cities in 8 countries. So indeed, where the bicycle and now where my family is, my young son and my husband are also here with me.
We will get back to those cities that you've lived in soon, but let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about you and what you do at the World Wildlife Fund.
Yes, well, if I could, in addition to being a cosmopolitan nomad, I think I would call myself a nature lover in the city. My motto is good city, good nature. So I think it really resonates with this topic and I'm excited to dig a bit deeper into it. I have a background in urban climate governance. I've worked with local authorities and UN agencies. But for the last almost 8 years, I've been with World Wildlife Fund, WWF, as the global lead for cities. WWF is one of the world's leading conservation organizations, the panda, if you will. We work in over 100 different countries, first and foremost on conservation, on forest conservation, on wetland conservation, on oceans. But increasingly so, especially for the last 10 years, we've been working in cities. Because we know that if we don't work with cities and local governments and all the different urban stakeholders, including yourselves, of course, if we don't get cities right, we can't really get our other goals right. So we need to work where people are living and try to create that galvanizing community. Within WWF, we have something called the One Planet City Challenge. I'll probably dig into that a little bit later. But where we really work with cities to do their data reporting on climate action and help them to align with the Paris Agreement and the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal. Increasingly, though, we're also working on topics including urban nature-based solutions, urban food systems, behavior change, and public engagement. So I'll stop there. I know we'll continue as we go forward.
So many things. Okay, well, let's get on to you, Joseph. Where are you joining us from today?
Hi, Michelle. I'm joining from London. However, I'm originally from Germany, also a half person, half British and half German. And I've lived in London for the last 15 years.
And tell us a little about your role. What is Foresight and what do you do at Arup?
Yeah, thank you. I'm Arup's global Foresight leader. And of course, the question arises, well, what does that actually mean? I'm essentially a professional futurist and I have been for the past 15 years ago. I've got an academic background in biology and innovation management. And I'm really interested in our long-term future and the question of, well, what will our world look like in 10, 20, 50 years' time? And crucially, what do we want our future to look like? So I'm very, very keen on understanding the trends and drivers shaping our collective future. And also, due to my background in biology, how systems change and evolve over time. And as a team, I guess that means we look at the future of cities, we look at the future of water, we look at the future of buildings, all of those different domains and sectors that Arup is active in today. And we do this both for the company to support our own leadership and decision making, but also for our clients to achieve better outcomes on the projects that we do.
Well, before we get to the future, let's talk about some of the current stats. Over half of the world's population lives in cities and they consume about 75% of natural resources and produce around 50% of global waste. Now, we know that can't be sustainable. So, Joseph, I know you've been researching deep into this area. Can you help us to understand regenerative design more and what it can do to help these stats?
So, at a very basic level, regenerative design is about the pathway to a world where human and natural systems coexist and co-evolve in harmony, and essentially where we're no longer doing harm to the planet and to ecosystems, where everything humans use, consume, and build sits within the planet's boundaries. However, if we would hypothetically, and let's assume this for a second, do no more harm tomorrow, so emissions stop, ecosystem destruction stops, pollution stops, and so forth, we would still be living on a planet that has been significantly degraded already. So regenerative design is therefore also about a pathway to restore and repair the damage that we have already done. Now, crucially, what living in harmony with nature means from one place to another is totally context dependent. Symbiotic relationships with nature are different in northern Brazil compared to northern Germany. So local context matters massively when it comes to regenerative design. And so does, as a consequence, local and indigenous knowledge in terms of what can be done to achieve, you know, these outcomes that we're talking about. In terms of what it means in practice, it is important to note that this is not about fancy new technology or complex solutions, in my view. It's about being more ambitious, getting real about the challenges we're facing and recognizing that just being sustainable and not doing harm is no longer enough. So one thing is we need to work to achieve is really net positive outcomes in everything we do. So imagine a building that consumes more carbon than it produces, a city that creates fresh water, a road that enhances biodiversity instead of degrading ecosystems. So we need to be way, way more ambitious in the outcomes we're trying to achieve through our designs, through our investments, and the shaping of the built environment around us.
So good. And there are so many great examples of this happening in different cities. Now, Jennifer, as a world traveler, you've lived in lots of places. You've obviously studied lots of cities and you're very passionate about this topic. So can you talk to us about maybe your favorite examples of regenerative design and maybe some of your favorite cities that do this well?
Yeah. And thank you, Joseph. I found myself kind of going down the rabbit hole, if you will, as you were describing that and really kind of envisioning the future of cities and feeling very hopeful for what everything that is a part of this definition of regenerative design. Well, kind of going to some, for me, there are so many cities out there that are doing fantastic things, certainly not enough. But cities for me, they've been kind of my mentors and my friends. And some of my favorite cities are the ones that struggle. Because they have those character building stories that provide hope, that provide that moment of transition. So I thought to just pick out three out of so many, is particularly Malmö in the south of Sweden, Medellin in Colombia, and Rotterdam in the Netherlands. These are all very personal cities for me as well. I used to work for the local authority in Malmö, a city that has done great things on new building projects, 100% renewable, green space management planning, but also retrofitting existing areas, doing a lot of what is can be called regenerative design, green roofs, open stormwater management, bringing people from the neighborhoods out into the community to really get to know each other and to be part of that solution. Fast forward Malmö from the late 1990s until where it is today to be a real future and present leader of sustainability, looking at showing that not just envisioning something, but showing that, you know, creating tangible examples of hope. We can do this, and cities are doing this already now. Medellin has had many years in Colombia, many years of struggle from crime, from mismanagement of resources, et cetera, et cetera. And what is so exciting about the story of Medellin is it's really about top down meets bottom up. Visionary leaders, local mayors together with local citizens and really kind of deciding we're going to take our city back. Creating parks that connect different parts of the community and also nature above the city. But also, I want to point out one project, which is the building of 36 green corridors throughout the city, green and blue corridors, which have addressed urban heat island, bringing the temperature down a few degrees, creating significant amounts of jobs and tackling air quality problems. And when we all are all facing the reality of climate change, I know in Europe and Northern Africa and North America right now, huge amounts of heat waves, looking at the role of nature to cool our cities is so important. And then finally, Rotterdam, a city in the Netherlands that has had, you know, so much struggles dating back to World War II and going forward. But it's never been a city that has sorrowed in its struggles, but instead kind of lifting and rolling up the sleeves and saying, what can we do now? And I wanted to point out the Rotterdam Energy approach to planning as a really fun way of kind of laying maps on top of each other, if you will, laying an energy map on top of an urban planning map and saying, how can we reuse energy, recycle resources? So, for example, putting a swing pool next to an ice hockey rink or putting a new apartment building next to an office building and capturing and cascading those different energy or water resources to really do, as Joseph said, close those loops. Because it's a vision, but it's also happening. And so it's really exciting to see what cities are capable of. Not enough, but we're moving in the right direction.
And if you're tuning into this podcast, it's called Sustainable Forces. You probably care about sustainability, and everything that Jennifer has just said is a no-brainer, right? We know that this is what we need to do for our people on our planet. But Joseph, we're not doing this. And so there must be some challenges that stop cities from adopting this approach more broadly. Have you come across any? And are there any examples that you can think of?
Yeah, I guess in my view, in the age of the internet, availability of knowledge and information is no longer a limiting factor. So I don't think knowing what to do is necessarily the problem here. I think finance and institutional capacity are generally the issue, and in some cases, perhaps also a lack of incentives to do the right thing. But institutional capacity in particular, I think, is a big one. I think there's something like 10,000 cities worldwide now. That's one of the estimates. Yet the focus of dialogue and investment on change and innovation is often centered on those big and well-known cities like New York, London, or Shanghai, for example. But they're not struggling for cash and attention when it comes to, you know, change agenda and a focus on innovation. However, where change is perhaps needed most are all those thousands of cities, and they are huge in reality in terms of population numbers and crucially also in terms of growth projections. But where there is often not enough institutional focus and institutional capacity to implement that best available knowledge and that best practice, which we might be seeing in other parts of the world. So it's one thing to know what good looks like, but it's a totally different challenge to implement it and crucially also to afford it, because you can't sell a vision of a wonderful future to those who can't afford it. So I think the big international development banks can play a critical role here. We did some work with the Asian Development Bank on the future of transport. And much of that work ended up focusing on a vision and a set of tools to ensure that long-term thinking and a more holistic look at outcomes as we're trying to achieve in regenerative design are included in the capacity building and the major investment decisions that are made at a local level. So really empowering those member countries to make those right decisions and to take a broader look at outcomes into account when investments are being made and design decisions are being made and so forth. It's also, I guess, important to know that it's not only a city-specific thing. I mean, much of what we do in cities and consume in cities and try to do goes well beyond those city boundaries. It includes food production system, the extraction of natural resources, land management, and all of those things happen outside of the cities. And so crucially, regenerative design is also about taking into account those things that happen in the broader world around us and how those then shape consumption and decisions that happen within cities.
So many things. Jennifer, do you know what? I was listening to you before and I feel like, you know, I asked you for a few cities and you had a big list. And there are so many more. I want to dig a bit deeper because there are so many great examples in this. So taking, you know, some of the challenges that Joseph talked about, but thinking about the positive aspects of what can happen. Can you give us some more examples of your favorite cities that are doing well, or maybe projects that you've done at the World Wildlife Fund that really shine out that people can sort of read about or look into more?
Definitely. Well, we have a publication that we'll definitely share with you afterwards. But it came out in 2021, and it's 8 cases of what cities around the world from different development contexts are doing to address nature-based solutions. And not just what they're doing to address, you know, the nature-based solutions piece of it, but what are those co-benefits, the job numbers, the addressing urban health, addressing air pollution, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. So in addition to the cities we've already talked about, I wanted to jump over to Asia because Asia is one of the fastest growing regions in terms of urban development. So I wanted to speak specifically about Seoul and Singapore, Singapore being a city state, but both two cities that have kind of focused on daylighting creeks or going against gray infrastructure and instead using green and blue infrastructure to open up the centers of their cities to nature, to people. The city of Seoul did a fantastic daylighting project dug up the concrete, if you will, and brought back the creek at the very center of the city, increasing property values, reducing temperature, bringing back hundreds of species of fish and birds. And creating, a space for people to engage in the very center of one of the world's largest cities. Singapore has done the same thing when they had to revitalize an area that was going to be faced with huge amounts of flooding and instead said, okay, let's stop building gray infrastructure and let's build a park instead. And that has become one of the most important parts of the city for recreational purposes and also for nature in a very dense urban environment. There are so many examples around the world, but I think the challenge is they're not moving fast enough. I mean, what we see with the science out there, whether it's, precautionary tales about biodiversity loss or the warnings from the IPCC on climate change and meeting that 1.5 degrees Celsius target, we are not doing enough fast enough. I think the good news is, Joseph has really presented the theoretical picture of what we need to achieve. And there are tangible examples out there. So now it's really about connecting the dots and going faster together. I know that Joseph talked about capacity and finance as being struggles. I might add, political will. And this is something that I'm sure is not an unusual thing to say in such a podcast with a passionate audience on this topic. But, how do we galvanize that political will? How do we actually, show to a city leader that investing in nature in your city, thinking about topics about regenerative design, it's not just about minimizing environmental impact or improving ecosystem health. It's about people. And local governments and mayors are all about people. I mean, that is their populace. That is their voting populace. So we need to really show that these kinds of design principles with tangible evidence from so many cities around the world that, that they're bringing jobs, they're improving health, they're connecting communities, and there's places that people want to live, frankly. I used to live in Amsterdam. I'll just share that as a city that is so close to my heart. I spent almost 5 years living in Amsterdam. I had a blog when I was there called The Urban Observer, and it really was inspired by the love affair I had with that city. Every single time I hopped on my bicycle, rain or sun, I fell in love with that city. And I felt like an equal member of that entire community. And when it's raining or it's windy and everyone's on the bicycle, there's a certain level of equality because you're all struggling against the wind or you're all wet together. And so, you know, it creates a different dynamic of connection to the buildings, to the canals, but to the people around you as well. So yeah, there's a lot of examples out there. And yeah, I said cities are my mentors. So there's so many more I could share. Certainly, Seattle, a city that I spent a lot of my childhood in, is also doing a lot on nature-based solutions and open stormwater management. One could argue that they took a lot of those examples from learning from other cities like Berlin, like Amsterdam, like Malmo, et cetera, et cetera. Now I find myself in Santiago. And, you know, the 3 or 4 years I've been here, I've seen the cycling infrastructure explode. That's certainly not on the levels of what you would hope for in a city like Amsterdam or Copenhagen. But I have that same love affair in Santiago every time I got on my bike and I connect with this community. And I think that is, you know, this story, it's about your relationship to where you're living. It's not just about a design principle, but it's about how you connect with it as an individual and your community as well.
I feel like I want to get my bike and come and ride around Santiago with you.
I'll definitely show you around.
but what you're doing is explaining that, you know, cities are giving you a sense of well-being, and it's that how we feel and where our children grow up that's so important. Joseph, we're going to go back to the academic side of things, though, because you are about to release a report based on your research. Can you dig into a couple of examples on your ARIP project and let us know about this report, please?
Yeah, sure. And Jennifer's also making me want to move, either cycle or actually moving to another city, because I'm starting to get jealous of all the places she's lived at, but that's for another time. So I guess one of the beauties of ARIP is that we do invest in research, and it's not always quick. And it is often complex because we really like to go deep on the subject matter and really explore it from multiple angles. So the team's been looking at regenerative design for some time now, working with various different subject matter experts, both inside and outside of the firm, and trying to really figure out what it means. And I guess one thing the work really highlighted is how hard it is to actually get specific about what regenerative design means in practice. So a big part was pulling together case studies and thinking about the transitions needed, and also looking at frameworks that fit into this overall, you know, ambition and vision that we are describing as regenerative design. And those frameworks might include things like nature-based design or the circular economy or planetary boundaries and so forth. They're all part of this shift in ambition, if you like. And a lot of it is this idea of going from something to something new. So, for example, going from extractive systems towards humans co-evolving with Earth's living systems, from net negative outcomes to net positive outcomes, and so forth. So we did find a range of weak signals, if you like, of what is happening now. And in the world of foresight, lots of weak signals make a trend, and you can start to see a pattern emerging. So one example that I really enjoyed learning about is a project we're kicking off in the Netherlands called Habitat Royale. It's work we're doing together with the architects Meccano. And it's essentially a residential building in Amsterdam in the Zuidas district, which will feature several nature first principles. So there's an aim for being biodiversity, net positive, an aim to be energy positive, super low carbon footprint. It actually stores 30% more carbon than is emitted in the materials during construction. It looks to achieve, as a consequence, this idea of a maximum synergy between how energy, daylight, and ecology is managed. So, for example, the facade has been designed to provide habitat for different species. I guess the challenge with all of these examples is scale. You know, it's relatively easy to find these wonderful examples in small places, but we need this to happen on every project globally and not a few projects in well-developed parts of the world. So I think here, again, regulation and, as Jennifer has also said, political ambition play a big part. I think politics in general needs to be much more ambitious, and I think there's plenty of people who would be supportive of that. There is examples, again, of where things are happening at scale. Jennifer mentioned green roofs earlier, and since 2002, all new and renovated flat roofs in Switzerland must be green roofs. Singapore, another example already mentioned, is working to recycle 100% of construction waste. So significant change at scale is possible, and regulation can play a big part in this. And I think, again, how investments are made, how investments decisions are made, is another critical enabler of all of this.
That's so great. One of the things that I thought about in your response, Joseph, is that there's lots of individual examples of individual cities and countries doing their thing. But we know in this podcast that actually you get things done with the power of partnership, collaboration, working together. Jennifer, I know that the World Wildlife Fund and AREP have been working on some super interesting projects together. Can you tell us more about this partnership and what you're doing?
Sure. And I actually just wanted to flag one publication that we recently put out, which is kind of, we're calling it our WWF Climate Manifesto. And it has the title, Everyone, Everywhere, All at Once. And I think, you know, just what Joseph was saying is, you know, we have a lot of great things happening, but we really need to lift the scale to address the ambition that is actually needed. And I think that connects to your question, Michelle, on collaboration. That WWF's motto is together possible. So we couldn't do what we're doing without working with organizations like AREP. And I just wanted to flag a few areas where we have been working together on this, you know, collaboration approach. Just today, a colleague of mine noted a new report that AREP led called Unlocking Urban Energy Access. And this was for the Global Covenant of Mayors. WWF is a part of the Committee on Energy Access. So we were a part of that publication together with you, but kudos to AREP for leading that great work. And it's really about energy access and addressing poverty. So, you know, something that is so critical to this bigger picture story that we're talking about as well. We also have worked on the Nature-Based Play publication that you guys put together and that was presented in 2021 at the COP in Glasgow, COP26, I think it was, and really kind of exciting to look at. It's not just about, you know, all of this theory, but how to make it meaningful. What kind of cities, not just do we want to live in, but do we want our children to live in? And as a new mother, that resonates even more. I was pregnant when I was writing my small part of that publication, but now having a small boy and he's starting to walk, you know, really the steps he's taking do we have access to those green spaces, those spaces that are safe and curious and enriching for a child like mine and so, so many others as well. And then I think our foremost area of collaboration is within the One Planet City Challenge, where we have been working with AREP for several years as our primary consultant to help develop the tools we use to assess city data. Now, what we do in the One Planet City Challenge is we help cities collectively, and we've worked with more than 700 cities in about 70 different countries to do their climate data reporting. And then with AREP, we extract that data to see how closely cities are aligned to the Paris Agreement and also what would be the quick wins as well as the more challenging areas to help push them in that direction if they haven't gotten there. The good news is in a few years, we've seen a doubling of cities that are aligned to the Paris Agreement. I think we went from 20 to 40. I can't remember what the number is right now. But again, that is far from where we need to go. So you know, this collaboration with you guys and so many others will, I think, definitely need to continue in order to keep that up and hit those targets that science says we need.
And the science is so crucial in all of this. Joseph, let's talk a little bit about your perspective on this. How important has the collaboration with clients like WWF and other clients been in this work?
Yeah, I guess not necessarily only clients, but like you said, crucially, you know, partners and important partners of ours. And I absolutely love the work we did with WWF on nature-based play. Before that, the team did some work on designing for urban childhoods, and we really explored how we can make cities better for children. And seeing children as an indicator species, essentially, if you design well for children and for elderly people, you design well for everyone else by default. So it's really, really important work, and it's great to have a partner like WWF to do it. And I guess it's one of the brands I grew up with. You know, growing up in North Germany in the 80s and 90s, this was kind of, you know, WWF was the gateway drug to our initial understanding of sustainability, if you like. You know, it was all about a first touch point of why the natural world matters, how it matters, why we need to care about it. And so I have a big personal affinity to this organization because I grew up with it, essentially. And if you would ask the average person on the street what WWF is, they could probably tell you what it is. And if you ask the average person what Arab is, that might be a bit harder because we are, I guess, a little bit more known in the circles of built environment practice. And so, but by teaming up, we can reach different audiences and new audiences. And we can also provide and combine different types of expertise. You know, Arab can bring the deep technical expertise and WWF can bring expertise in different areas. And so much like species in the natural world, as a biologist, I guess I would describe our partnership as a symbiotic relationship where both sides really benefit from the uniqueness of each other. The question I guess I have, which is an open question, is, you know, who else needs to be part of this gang? How can we get more organizations and individuals from developing and emerging countries into this dialogue to make sure it's not purely a Western view and we have really a broad range of different perspectives as we try to shape and create a better built environment, and we are as inclusive as we can be with the various voices that matter. And so, you know, looking forward, I'm really, you know, keen to explore who else can be part of these partnerships and what new things we can do together.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of people listening who now want to be part of these partnerships, inspired by what you two have talked about today. So how do people get started? Joseph, can you maybe help people who are inspired by what you've just said think about their maybe top three tips for how to get involved in regenerative design themselves?
Yeah, I'll try to keep this one short. So I guess there's lots of literature on the topic out there, and being out there and seeing also, you know, student work with the universities I'm engaged with, there's lots and lots of work happening in this space, and it's really diffusing through our professional practice at the moment. And in short, I think it's about really thinking net positive in everything we do and trying to identify positive outcomes we can achieve for humans and nature in our design and investment decisions. It's about building institutional capacity to adopt these new design approaches and principles. It's about also recognizing the reality of the situation. We have to be more uncompromising, and we have to demand better outcomes, and we have to do it now. And this has to happen on all of our projects. And again, it's not only about the developed world, it's also crucially about emerging and developing countries applying this thinking wherever possible. So the solutions are there, and we just need to get going, and finance and institutional capacity are key enablers of this, I think. So as a summary, regenerative design is not about complex technology that needs to be developed. It's about making better choices, setting higher ambitions, and making better use of the solutions that are already out there. And we need to make those available for all.
Jennifer, I too am the mother of young babies. I have twins. And I think when you have children, you really see your city in a very different light than perhaps you'd have seen it before. I just want to talk about something very specific that you worked on in partnership with Arup, which is the nature-based play report. For those of us who have children, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, some tips we can get from that report around the importance of playing in nature for our young people? And then I'll finish with you with one big piece of advice that you can provide for everybody, whether they've got kids or not.
Well, first of all, I want to Thank Joseph. I will share with my colleagues. I've never been called a gateway drug. So if it's a gateway drug for nature conservation, I'm happy to oblige on that. Nature-based play. I think it's really so many different aspects. I would say it was a very collaborative project. Myself, I was writing more kind of broadly about the importance of nature in cities and nature-based solutions. And then there were so many really interesting case studies, whether from Scotland or from Sweden. I can't remember all of them, but definitely it's a very useful storytelling piece as well. What would I say as a mother? I mean, speeds are something that I'm talking more personally, maybe not so much into the publication right now, but we have great speeds. We live in a slow speed community, not more than 30 kilometers an hour. That would be great if people actually followed those speeds. But every day when I'm on my bicycle with my son or on the sidewalk with the buggy, people are going by, I would say, almost 90 kilometers an hour. I dodged a little bit your question, but I think it's really about, you know, it's a bigger picture. There are the playgrounds, there are those spaces that children really play in, but it's our entire way of life. I mean, cities, most of the public space in our communities is dedicated to roads and cars. I mean, roads, highways, parking lots, these are not spaces for play. So how do we kind of dig up that concrete and create streets and spaces for people in nature? Thinking from the perspective of children and, you know, watching a new life walk for the first time, everything is interesting. Everything can be explored. But, you know, the other day, my son, who's just now getting confident in walking, opened the door of the daycare as we were leaving, and I'm pulling the stroller. And then I was so afraid that he was going to go out into the road and get hit by one of those cars that was going way too fast in a slow speed community. So, you know, this is for me, one of the areas where we can, maybe I'm jumping to your next question about, you know, start small, follow what is already there. I think, you know, people always ask me, I've lived in a lot of different places, and they say, you know, what would you do in my community? How could we make our community more sustainable? Well, look, it's already out there. We have, for example, in Santiago, we have great bike lanes, but why are not enough people using them? We have great legislation on slow speeds and safe speeds. A lot has been done of it. I would say it's one of the most progressive legislations in the world, but nobody's following it. So how do we create that connection? I mean, these issues are so overwhelming. Climate change, biodiversity loss, complex and interrelated challenges that you can feel so overwhelmed it's not even worth doing anything. Or start small and connect those dots. So maybe you can't tackle the whole city, but maybe you can tackle the road in front of your home, build a sidewalk, and talk to your neighbors, you know, create communities with other parents. Because if there's one thing that as a Swedish person we learned from Greta Thunberg, if you sit outside the parliament as an adult and hold a sign that says, I'm protesting climate change, people might think you're a little crazy. But if you do that as a young person and you bring in other young people, you can create a global movement from one simple idea to, you know, the complexity and the idea, the possibilities are endless.
Thank you, Jennifer. Your passion is contagious, and it's one of the reasons that this podcast has been so delightful. And Joseph, thank you for all of your academic research and insights into this subject. I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did, especially the tips and takeaways you can incorporate into your own workplace. There are links in the show notes to the projects that we spoke about. In our next episode, I'll be chatting with David Miller from C40 Cities and Arup's Bryce Richards on how to grow a green economy. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favourite streaming service.